quick review. Well, welcome back, by the way. The main ideas. Remember, we started with projection, and we talked about what's projected to the collective unconscious, and now we're talking about different aspects of the collective unconscious using fairy tales and myth to depict the nature of the unconscious so we can understand what's involved when we project it. So we're now on demons. And so she starts off with the negative manifestations of the unconscious. It'll get positive. This first part's kind of depressing. What we did last time was look at fairy tales where the demon, as what is projected, could only be fled from. So in other words, there are situations that push your button because you're projecting something, but there's no point in trying to solve it because it's just overpowering. And in that case, it's not a cop-out to avoid. Then we got into what causes complexes to become demonic. That was on 100 and 101. And to sum that up very simply, it's often when something is cut down, when something in you is not permitted to live. You know, I think of an example of a woman who was a very talented artist, but was not allowed to draw pictures as a kid until she finished her math homework, saying, you know, art is inferior to thinking, and so on. That's the kind of stuff that causes complexes to become negative and persecutory. And then that's where we stop. I wanted to go back to one quick point on 104. We stopped at 105. An aside. Our complexes, another way to put this maybe, is are what we call spirits, you know, people who see ghosts and stuff like that, merely complexes that are projected, or is there some non-psychological reality to the existence of ghosts and spirits? And the reason I point to it is just kind of a humorous interlude. Jung wrote an essay here in volume 8 called The Foundation of the Psychological Beliefs in Spirits very early on in his life. I don't know what the year was, 1910, something like that. In which he said, you know, all this belief in ghosts and spirits is a projection of the unconscious. And then he rewrote the essay and he put in a footnote, I no longer feel as certain as I did in 1919, when I wrote this sentence. To put it bluntly, I doubt whether an exclusively psychological approach can do justice to the phenomena in question. So he corrected himself, and we're not sure what's going on, but I think we have to hold out the possibility that there are real objective spirits sometimes. So we will start on 105. But the last two paragraphs talk about what do we mean by demonic. We could almost say what do we mean by evil, and that's to give an intellectually complete definition might be impossible, but a working definition is what negates and destroys. That's what's called black magic in the primal mind.
That's similar to what is a weed, you know, that's all dependent on whether you want that thing growing in your yard or not.
It's very complicated, yes.
The person saying this is, because if we look at what Christianity says is evil, sometimes evil ends up being a good thing, you know, from a Jungian perspective.
That's why it's very hard to define. Because, I mean, it's not frequent, but it's not unknown that these evil figures in dreams can have a positive role. So it's a very loose definition. And I don't know if we can ever really say what is evil. I think in my dreams, I think I've seen one dream of my own in which I saw a figure that was evil. Some of you may have remember we talked about the dream of Victor the Russian. That, I think, was evil. And often what we think is evil is because we're so easily threatened and overpowered by something that its overpowering nature causes us to call it evil. So be aware that it's a very fluent concept. But on the practical emotional level, you know, when you're dealing with somebody or yourself who is constantly putting people down, putting you down, disregarding your talent, belittling what you have to offer, I think you can say, as a working definition, that's evil, and I'm going to fight it.
But Gary, sometimes there are things that initially destroy something but make it turn.
Yeah.
That brings the trajectory up, and there are other things that initially look good and quickly make a bound trajectory down. So it's hard to see.
Very hard.
In the moment.
Yeah.
You could say.
But I think still, maybe these are degeneralizations or dangerous. I would say it's almost never a good thing to not tell the negative voice to shut up. Certainly when it's paralyzing you.
And the internal negative voice?
Yeah. Well, either way. Either way.
It's almost like, I always think that, you know, when Jung always made the opposites.
Yeah.
Good people, love, power. I mean, it's almost like you need that inner, that tension and that interplay So, I mean, you need it just to get the movement going. But then, like you say, it's hard to tell where on the line. It's relative then. I mean, it's personal. What ends up being good or...
It's very complicated.
But it helps, I think, you've got this opposite, you know, mm-hmm. interplay. In order for there to be life.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Okay, so that's just a little point of an important point, but a very unclear one. And we're on 106. She then takes that idea over to the social sphere and points out how contagious these demonic complexes are. And then makes, I think, a really interesting point. Let's go down and say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six lines down, when in such mass psychoses, that mass psychoses would be, you know, say Nazism or any destructive movement. I think, you know, for example, remember it showed up in the same movie of the Dixie Chicks? Anyone see that? Well, they came out against George Bush in the war very, very early, and they were almost killed, I mean, literally. The public sentiment against them was so hostile. Their radio station would have parties where they would burn their CDs, and they refused to play the music. That kind of a thing, where there's a group thing that is highly destructive, points to a demonic complex that's become infecting.
And that's interesting because, you know, the scapegoat
psychology,
you know, it's just like in business, you always thought that the group had to have somebody to blame for what was going on. And so the whole, you know, so when the group got together, they pinpointed who's to blame. like, oh my God.
It's pathetic and dangerous.
And you wouldn't have that one-on-one.
Right. They do that now in Zurich. I was telling me, what's it called? There's a name for it. I'll think of it. But it's almost like people get together and decide, that's the troublemaker, and we're going to go after them. What's that called? I'll think of it. But it's a real problem in business there, apparently, now, according to my friend.
Because, I mean, you know, then they think, well, if you have a scapegoat, then you solve the problem, and then you're off the hook. And solve anything.
No. You know, when I was in grad school, I worked at a school for delinquent kids. This was the last stop before jail for most of them. And what was so amazing to notice, there would be one real asshole in the group. I mean, constantly setting fire, trying to set fire to the school, beating people up, you know, bringing drugs. That guy would get kicked out. Somebody else would take that role. It was sure esque, and so I think there's somebody who is used to being scapegoated, and that's a role that has to be fulfilled in an unconscious situation. That really hit me. What she does with that, I think, is really good for thought. So when in such mass psychosis, chaos erupts from the unconscious, it is seeking new symbolic ideas which will embrace and express not only the previous order, but also the essential contents of the disorder. So, you know, the positive side of this demonic stuff, which is in a way what you folks were intuiting, is these demons are unexpressed talents very often. And the problem isn't the demon. The problem is we who don't have a mind big enough to understand and work with what is assaulting us. But between A and B, it's a huge, vast shift.
When that Nietzsche seminar I thought was so helpful, and Jung has said, you know, don't put the unexpressed, or we could say so-called negative emotions in the retort, in the vessel, and let them cook between two people. If we're having a conflict or bad feelings between us, to put that in there, because they were not projecting the evil on the other person.
Yeah.
And it has a chance to cook and maybe change and maybe, you know, find what would be constructive.
Very important.
That was just like a really... And then Barbara Hanna said, the devil got in here. Let's start all over again.
Yeah.
And that was a good way of putting it.
Yeah, I can see her saying that. Mm-hmm. And all this presupposes you cannot do this, but rather say, you know, here's how I am emotionally at this moment. And then if two people can say, these are my emotions, then there's a chance of doing that. But boy, that's a tough place to get to. Versus you are doing this versus I am feeling this. Very difficult.
I mean, it's almost like both people have to be working.
Both have to be working.
Or except that there's a third thing, third entity going on.
Yes.
So then in a mass psychosis, it's even that much less likely.
Yeah.
If it's hard between two.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, just like what's happening in Washington, it almost forces people to take sides.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other side's the bad one. Mm-hmm.
That's why I like what she says here. It will express, embrace, and express both sides.
Where is that, Gary?
When in such mass psychosis, chaos erupts from the unconscious, it is seeking new symbolic ideas which will embrace and express not only the previous order, but also the essential contents of the disorder.
So really at that point, it's kind of an agent of change.
Yes.
When we are held in a system that isn't working anymore, the possibility, that would be in the complex,
mm-hmm.
the possibility that something evil is going to erupt out of that is greater, could we say that?
Mm-hmm.
And that is to show us, hey, look what's going on here.
Yes.
You need to ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of that can maybe become something creative.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I like so much is how that new thing must be a bridge. You know, when you get fed up with something and you want something new, you forget that the new thing has to embrace the old as well. I think that's why revolutions end up producing the same thing they started to be against.
They end up being a swing away from it, not an intervention.
Yeah. Okay, so a creative achievement, therefore, has become a necessity. So we see that demonism and creativity are psychologically very close to each other. That was the point we were getting to.
That could explain why so many really creative people are living on the edge.
Absolutely. And if you take away that edge, you take away their creativity.
Well, you were explaining, I don't know, last time about a young boy who was very artistic, and that you had suggested that he have a conversation with this character.
Yeah.
And then it kind of took him over.
It took him over.
Until
that
ego is strong enough.
Right.
To negotiate both sides.
Yeah.
Because you really have to kind of step in, I think, as a really creative person. You have to be able to step in and live in both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
But that brings up, what is the equivalent of the ego in a mass psychosis? I mean, how do you, if you have a mass psychosis with a scapegoat, you get rid of the scapegoat and then somebody else takes over the scapegoat role. So, I guess I wonder how it is that you move forward in that scenario. I just don't even
probably a hero.
That's what's scary about mobs, because a young kid, the lowest level
mm-hmm.
of the psychological development will prevail.
Right.
Well, so yeah, it's like, okay, yeah. That'll take over. And unless if you say, maybe something. Someone can step above that and lead him forward.
Or like mm-hmm. Mahatma Gandhi, somebody refuses to be unconscious, and then I think there's both the, that primitive mind that sort of buys into the, whatever chaos is going on, but there's also some element of consciousness in people that can kind of hook into, if someone stays mm-hmm. completely sane, I think it's possible for sanity to prevail, so I think consciousness is the only answer to that, because it's, and that's the only answer to unconsciousness is someone has to stay, sane.
Mm-hmm.
And that person usually either gets killed or they make a huge difference.
Yeah.
Look at Nelson Mandela again. He could have come out saying, fuck these whites, let's just pay him back, but he didn't. And he saved the country of enormous amounts of destruction.
And that person, I think, undergoes a tremendous amount of suffering.
Oh, tremendous.
Tremendous amount of suffering. And it takes, it's not something that happens like that.
Yeah.
He was in jail for, how many years?
How many years? Decades.
Yeah, decades. That's what it takes, is to suffer that and stay conscious, which is what it takes for us to grow out of anything, is to suffer and stay conscious. That's the answer.
Yeah. Well said.
I think that hero person always becomes a scapegoat and gets kicked out.
I think maybe that's the difference with some people who then are able to withstand and not take on the scapegoat being projected on them.
Yeah, like Mandela. You suffer tremendously, but he didn't get made the scapegoat, or he did get made the scapegoat by some people, but he refused to take on that role, and he allowed himself to be punished as if he were, but, you know, became, you know, definitely a symbol and a hero figure.
And, you know, I hate to use these words, but there's a little bit of magic involved in the thing working. Mm-hmm. But often it doesn't work.
There is, because in being that hero, you're the way that you find a way to kind of, like, step aside and not take on that scapegoat. I mean, there is some creative, you know, they reframe the whole conversation.
And I think some sort of divine power has to come through them, not to get taken over or, you know, to just give up, you know, and rot in jail and die or whatever, you know.
Like, or get bitter, I think. That's
get bitter.
The scapegoat gets bitter, and then he propagates or she propagates the very thing that he or she's against.
Right, there's no antidote in that.
Yeah.
That was, when you say hero, could we redefine it as the Gilgamesh hero?
Yes.
Gilgamesh had to suffer and become more humane. I don't know about the projecting thing, but it would take that kind of a hero, not the old Siegfried hero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
But, that one lady who's willing to not just stay in the ego power mode.
Yeah, there's a real difference between the hero that takes on the projection and accepts the projection of everyone that really isn't connected to any standpoint to himself, and, say, the Gandhi kind of hero who does have a different standpoint and stays true to that standpoint the whole time.
So that, and part of that paragraph, she brings it back to the individual, how Jung felt psychosis could only be cured through creativity. And then the last part of that chapter, it's not as important as others, I didn't feel. What these demons are, she points out in the italicized section, is creative fantasies, if they can be transformed. And then she talks about what can be integrated and not. I didn't think that was that important, so that takes us over to the demons of antiquity. You okay so far with that stuff?
Are there just some demons that you can never face? She does talk in Shadow and Evil and Fairy Tales that there's some evil that we just should never touch in the psyche.
I think so.
And we talk about that where you have, like, in the fairy tale, that you have to run away.
No.
Yeah, like it's the only one.
I think so. That's certainly one thing I've learned since I've been working. Don't try to deal with it. Well, the next chapter. Yeah.
Is there a clue that she's talking about in here that I missed about when you run and when you go?
No.
That would be a helpful piece of information. That you just, as an individual, you would follow your dreams and in a large mass psychosis situation.
Well, it's a lot harder in a mass psychosis. Go with the individual. You know, I just have kind of working hypotheses or rules of thumb. You know, when you're talking to somebody, when you touch on something and they just fall apart during the week. They can't get out of bed. They can't function. They spend days crying. They want to kill themselves. You know, where a comment that might irritate somebody else will totally knock them on their butt. That's, I think, a sign that they're not irresponsible. You know, sometimes people get in a mess because they're irresponsible. You just got to say, look, stop doing this shit, you know. But they're decent, responsible people who just can't function after certain conversations. I think that is a clue. It doesn't happen that often, by the way. But this would be, you know the psych language, this would be the borderline personality. A severe borderline personality who is just on the edge of a psychosis. I may have seen in all my time here two or three like that. And what you do constantly is look for the positive in their life. Almost everything we say Christianity has screwed us up with, we employ. You know, what's right about you, and stay away from that, and let's look at the things that did go right. As soon as you go into the negative, it just overwhelms them. Or another person might get depressed, and they might get angry at you, but, and they may lose a day in feeling crummy, you know, but they don't turn to blubbering jello. So that's a working answer. Again, there might be times when you would actually want that, but you got to be damn careful that they can spring back. Suppose they can't spring back. So that's the sort of questions that go through my mind. You know, just the fact that, I mean, it sounds silly, but the fact that you can come to a meeting regularly, that means you have an ego. And there are people who can't do that. Mm-hmm. And so that's where you're thinking, okay, I better be careful. As far as mass psychoses, I don't know. You know, here we have the Ku Klux Klan, so it's really not that far away from us. I personally think our involvement in the Middle East is kind of a mass psychosis.
In what?
In the Middle East is kind of a mass psychosis. I guess you just have to consult your individual conscience. Will that save the situation? Probably not.
Hey, Gary, before we move on, I had a question back on 103. What's really going on about the one-sidedness?
Yes.
And I guess I just was, the first big paragraph there, you know, talks about the best analogy of the way in which a demon tends to
become.
It just got me thinking about the whole idea of one-sidedness and why they do become one-sidedness. I mean, what's underneath that? Is it kind of
affect
you wanting to be whole, and so you have to go?
No, I think it's just the destructive side of the unconscious. And the complex usurps all the willpower. So, I remember a woman who had a certain gift for pottery making. But soon as she would start, she could not stop. She'd go days without sleeping. Just turned into a fiend. Everything had to be perfect. So that's an example of the one-sidedness. She you know, she wouldn't eat, she wouldn't shower, she wouldn't keep up with friends. That she has such a single focus, and that's what a demon does to us.
And so then further down in the paragraph, about halfway down, she says autonomous complexes behave in exactly the same way.
Yeah.
So then complexes that are autonomous and ones that aren't? Can you say more about that?
Well, I think all complexes are autonomous to begin with. Mm-hmm. If what we try to do in our work is establish, build a bridge to them.
Okay.
Yeah. Some are more autonomous than others, but a complex by definition is what we can't control. Mm-hmm. Okay? Demons of antiquity. I don't think we need to go into all the details here, but really sit with one main idea. That is, the word for demon in English comes from the Greek word daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N, transliterated. And the difference is demon carries a negative evaluation and daimon does not. So originally these demons or daimons were just taken as parts of human nature or even spiritual reality which overpower. And it didn't necessarily mean bad. In some of Plato's work, Eros is called a daimon, meaning once you get snagged, you're caught. And we'll see later, it's only with Christianity that these daimons were thought of as demons. And that really helps in working with our own complexes to try to not judge them, if at all possible. Sometimes I think we have to if they are leading us into self-destructive behavior or behavior that's destructive to others. But where possible, to see what feels bad, not as bad, but as morally neutral, which we have to establish a relationship to. That's really the point of this section. So she refers to the Old Testament, talking about the spirit of lust or spirit of jealousy. That would be a daimon. She talks about Plato as well using the word daimon with some ambiguity. And at the bottom of the page, she gets into another discussion which I don't feel I can clearly explain the difference between gods and demons. Or gods and daimons. She'll go on with that for a while. This is how I envision a demon or a daimon. The person involved is generally okay to relate to until a certain thing gets hit. And when that thing gets hit, they lose it. They may become accusatory, they may feel guilty, they may become negative, they may become idealistic. It's like there's a corner of the personality that's still rattling around, where the gods are more aspects of the whole personality. Eros, for example, in a healthy person is something that is integrated into their lifestyle. And that would be more of a god. But take that loosely. She tries to make a distinction. I'm not sure how successful it is. But just so you're aware that they're almost the same thing when we say an inner god or an inner daimon. But I think, for my taste, a slight variation in that. For me, demons are behaviors that can be triggered by a certain circumstance. I remember a guy once who, pretty level-headed guy, but as soon as the conversation would turn to California, he would just, those dumb hippies, those stupid plastic people. Where'd that come from? Well, guess what? He had an affair with a California woman that went sour. So generally, he was reasonable, except when you hit that painful spot. That's how I would think of a demon or a daimon. Another good word for daimon is about a third of the way down page 109, a storm. You know, you have calm days, you have stormy days. And when you got a demon or a daimon, you have storms. And if it's a sunny day, you're completely reasonable. If it's a stormy day, your friends better watch out.
I remember Jung said that a diamond took him over the right answer to Joseph's topic.
Right. Well, you know, as you were doing the Red Book, he's wrestling with all his diamonds and making sure that he prevails. We'll talk a little bit how to integrate this stuff as we go along. What is integration? That's 109. Another word which, I'm just hitting the main points here. Go down 2, 4, 6, 7 lines on 110. Powers. I'm just trying to give you other words for demon or daimon. Your powers or storms. Then she tries to distinguish between demons and gods on 110, end of the second paragraph. I'm not sure what I said is in agreement with this or not, but demons are closer to the ego. That's what I meant by saying they can be triggered. Where gods, she calls archetypal ground structures. I think it's a little artificial, that distinction. But take your pick. Okay, that's. I think you don't need to know Plato, you don't need to know all these names. Plutarch, Clement of Alexandria, who cares? For our beginning purposes. But if you remember the really important thing that demons originally were not negative.
Were not what?
Negative. Daimons. In fact, with people who are stable, we try to recover those diamonds. Get passion back in life. Yeah, it'll make a mess, but what do you got now? You're bored to death.
You're just saying it sounds like diamond.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I think really, this is a little optimistic maybe, but with a few exceptions, these daimons are friends in disguise. You just got to survive their onslaught. And you can defend yourself by saying they don't exist, or you can live them out blindly and not ask what they mean, which is exactly the same as denying them. You don't ever get to what they're trying to tell you.
This was really strong in the ancient Romans, because when we were in a lot of the museums in and around Naples, there would just be all of these little ceramic pieces where people were making offerings to these daimons, I guess. So if you were having a problem with a part of your body, you couldn't become pregnant, you would make a piece of clay that looked like your foot or your womb or whatever. And these were offerings that they made to appease those gods. So this was very, very strong.
And I think
we just saw thousands.
Really?
Yeah, oh yeah, that they had recovered.
See, that's a much different view of the psyche than we got. And I think it's healthier. Because we squash the psyche through reason. Oh, that's not reasonable. But they could acknowledge, they may not have been able to integrate, but they could acknowledge the existence of this stuff. And you can't integrate what you haven't acknowledged.
I don't know if anyone saw the movie The Golden Compass.
Yeah, I love the books are amazing.
Yeah, so each character there has their personal thing.
Uh-huh.
And it's an animal.
Yeah, and it's an animal. Mm-hmm. And it's just so cool.
In a way, that's what we're trying to accomplish in our work. Mm-hmm. The muse, for example, was a daimon, a person's muse. Well, we try to put people in touch with their creative voice. And if you're creative, you know why muse is called daimon, because this creative drive can be horrendously strong. Stronger than anything else. So, we are trying to, while respecting reason, honor, reason or not, there are things in us which we have to deal with. And that could be put as getting in touch with our, and establishing a relationship to our daimon. And usually they are morally uncomfortable in the way they present themselves. Demons in Christianity, as she says, things didn't change much in the recognition of demons, but what changed is they became negative. This next paragraph and the next page I want to look at very closely because I think it's some wonderful material. I'll just read you starting on 111 and stop me if you want to discuss something. These views went back to the book of Enoch, 100 BC, Old Testament, in which the story, as we know or don't know, is told of certain angels who fell in love with human women and descended from heaven to be with them. Together they gave birth to a destructive race of giants who laid the whole earth to waste. As Jung explained, if looked at psychologically, this signifies a precipitate invasion of human consciousness by contents of the collective unconscious. The reason she's mentioning it is, we'll see in a moment, this is the situation she feels we are dealing with today. Crime, what's called narcissism, greed, sexual promiscuity, all of those are demons or daimons that are invading us from the collective unconscious, as far as Jung is concerned. And now, why? Well, we'll figure that out in a moment. But we are living in a time of the activation of demons or daimons. That is a characteristic of our time. The giants are images of the resultant inflation that leads to a catastrophe for mankind. The fall of the angels, in Jung's words, enlarged the significance of man to gigantic proportions, which points to an inflation of the cultural consciousness of that period. So these angels would represent the aspects, let's say the daimonic aspects of the collective unconscious, which are invading. And with all that power, we get inflated. And the let's call it the demonic aspect of technology and science, that's where it has its root for Jung. Rather than ask, what does this invasion mean, we act it out. And it was a question of an all-too-rapid growth of knowledge, exactly as is the case today. So that's why she mentions it. And we'll have a dream in a moment.
This is part of the process, right? This kind of step, when you have this happening in the culture at large, it's part of a process of something
yes.
coming into
right.
to being.
Right.
So it's kind of a necessary step.
Yes, it is. Necessary, but with huge destructive capacities, yet portending something very positive.
I wonder how, the fact that he lived during World War One and Two.
Yeah.
I think she did too.
Yeah.
That just brought these things out, so made them so much more prominent.
And right.
Obvious, because they saw the destruction so on a vast scale.
That the destruction of those wars would be the giant. And he's looking behind that to see what is causing that is an influx of demonism, daimonism, with, as Kathy pointed out, an ulterior, deeper meaning, but we don't get to that meaning and we live out the influx.
And we've talked in the past about how it takes a certain amount of inflation in order to make a change or to do something new in the world. And you just wonder collectively, what's that new step? Because if everyone's getting hit with that kind of inflation, is that part of the process of building up the ego in order to make this cultural change?
I don't know. I don't see how we're going to get out of it.
Right. We won't know until we're on the other side of it.
Well, I think we can see it in individuals very clearly. Mm-hmm. What looks like a, I can't take it anymore, or I can't go on, or I keep getting these same messes, that you can see very often is an influx from the unconscious that doesn't have to have a negative outcome. And if we can work with it, turn it around. And as I said, then that influx actually turns out to be a friend. But how do you do that socially? I don't know.
Well, if we take the financial crisis that just occurred, a lot of people asked a lot of questions and they changed how they lived their lives. And so that brought about a certain amount of change out of that inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So it does happen. It probably happens a lot on the individual level and has an effect that way. But I don't know if it makes big changes for everyone.
But once you know this point of view, it is an interesting lens to look at political events through. Ask yourself, is this an invasion? Are we looking at giant? Certainly Bernie Madoff's classic giant. Will that influx be transformed? Is the question we're not getting. So we'll get a dream here in a second that talks about it. This story from the Book of Enoch is once more especially timely because it is obvious that today two such invasions from the collective unconscious, such invasions of collective contents from the collective unconscious occur frequently. This can be illustrated by the account of a dream of an American unknown to me, which was sent to me just as I was writing the chapter on demons. I don't know if any of you remember, this is, actually Edinger sent her that dream, and it's in, here somewhere, Archetype of the Apocalypse.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, so it's in here.
Yeah.
I'm walking with a woman along the, I don't think it is Edinger's dream, but he reported it. I'm walking with a woman along the Palisades. Palisades, you know, is that part of New York, right across the Hudson, kind of a park in there, where one can have a panoramic view of New York City. A man is leading us. New York is a mass of ruins. We know that the world has been destroyed. Fires are burning everywhere. Thousands of people are fleeing in all directions in panic. The Hudson River has flooded large sections of the city. It is twilight. Fiery balls in the heaven are spinning toward the earth. It is the end of the world. That's the apocalyptic aspect. The cause is a race of giants which has come from extraterrestrial space. In the midst of the ruins, I see two of them sitting casually, picking up people and eating them by the handfuls with a nonchalance as though they were eating grapes at the table. Now that would represent people who are consumed by financial greed, sexual greed, who are just being gobbled up by their desire. I mean, it looks like they are living a active life in the world, but if you look at their dreams, they are puppets of their desire. The giants have different sizes and shapes. My guide explains that they come from different planets where they live together in peace and harmony, and that they landed in flying saucers. The fiery balls mean more such landings. In fact, our Earth had been set up by giants in the very beginning. If you know the Wagner's Ring, it's interesting that giants built the world there as well. The Earth is, so to speak, their hothouse, and now they are coming back to harvest their fruits. There is a definite reason for this, which I will discover later. Now, I love this next part. I am rescued because I have high blood pressure. You follow that? Oh. It is good to be upset. It is good not to be healthy in the face of this craziness. So often people say, oh, I can't stand life the way it is. I have to say, you may be the healthy one. Because you can't go along with the superficiality, the scapegoating, the lack of depth. That's, That I think, apropos your question a little bit, Kathy, how do we get out of it is we realize we don't want to be in it. That it's good to be maladapted. That is why I have been chosen to undergo this test. If I pass it, I will become a saver of souls like my guide. You walk on, and suddenly I see before me an enormously high golden throne on which the king and queen of the giants are sitting. I think this too goes to your question, Mother Kathy. They are the intelligence behind the destruction of the planet. To pass my test, I have to climb up a stairway to them. It is a very difficult ascent. I am afraid, but I know I have to do it. The world and mankind are at stake. I awake, bathe in sweat from the dream. So, what she makes of the king and the queen is it's a hieros gamos. Remember that? The king and the queen would mate have intercourse in some tower in Babylonia in that ancient Near East as part of the New Year's ceremony, and the fecundity of the life of the village and of the farmers depended on their doing that. So it's an image of fecundating, is that a word? Life. And I think for our way of looking at it would be a new value system is in the process of being created. And all this influx is a return of what had been called bad, because we need to increase our breadth of understanding of human nature, of ourselves, and how can we live in touch with our bodies and our human nature and our physical nature. So there's what's going on. A new world's being prepared. And what that preparation does is release a terrific amount of daimons into public life.
It's interesting how, unlike 9/11, the beginning of the stream.
I agree. Yeah, I think I told you the story of that woman I was talking to on September 11th. I was talking to a woman here who had a psychotic episode and was getting her feet back on the ground. She just came to see me that one time, and you'll see why she didn't come back. And she told me, New York City, it's burning. People are jumping out of buildings. It's terrible. There's fire everywhere. They're overburdened. That's a classic psychotic delusion. I thought, oh my God, she's going crazy. And I tried to downplay it. It wasn't a psychotic delusion. It was the truth. That's how crazy it is. And I think how my idea of how a psychosis could look at her, this dream and that show that we're in this situation of simply being under assault by foreign forces. And the question is, can we come to terms with it?
And in fact, our earth has been set up by giants in the very beginning.
Yeah.
The earth is, so to speak, their hothouse. That sounds like a retort. And now they're cleansing. So, I mean, you know, it seems, and the fact that the Book of Enoch that she starts this with is written in the Old Testament, I heard.
Yes. Do you want to try to interpret that?
The fact that it was set up?
Yeah, that it was built by giants in the first place.
Archetypal forces?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's a right answer here. I can tell you my opinion goes along that lines that apparently just civilization itself is such an effort contrary to nature. You know, Jung's saying that mankind's biggest passion is laziness, that such willpower was required 2,000 years ago to establish this world, that it took an inflation, kind of what you were saying, Kathy, it took an inflation to make it, and it wasn't so bad then. Here, this is my interpretation, because there weren't so many people. Mm-hmm. We can't afford that anymore. When, how many nations have nuclear power, or nuclear weapons? Is it 9, something like that?
That high.
Well, yeah, around there, with, you know, Iran probably on the way. That thoughtlessness can't continue or we won't survive. Should I have a stretch?
On that high note.
On that high note?
Can I ask one more question?
Okay.
Could the inflation, the giants that originally created the earth, could that also be that, I guess along the same lines, the projections come up, and I was thinking, you know, you have these wandering people, they start becoming tribes because they can band together and work against the elements better. But that takes a certain amount of projection. They have to somewhat project that these people are helpful or whatever to even band together.
Mm-hmm. And project that nature is bad. Dominate the earth. You don't dominate something you love.
And even projecting on one another got them to band together, which was a positive.
But like we were saying, you have to, that presupposes a scapegoat. All of that belongs to the birth of consciousness. And we've talked about this in Ion a little bit, but that is now coming up for reevaluation. So that would be another of the aspect of the value system that's trying to be born. A respect for nature, eros more important than power, so on. Okay, stop thinking and...